Hello, sports fans. A couple pre-episode notes. Number one is that the internet reading from this week is very explicit and sexual and not horny, but there's a lot of fun butthole words in it. If you want to skip 17 minutes of us talking about that, skip to around 16, 17 minutes and you should be good. I know that's usually part of our bit, but it's excessive enough that I thought it might be good to put in a warning. Number two is during the episode, I decided to eat a bunch of Smarties, and I thought the packaging wouldn't pick up on the microphone. It really does. It's very obvious, especially at one point, it's almost unbearable. So I apologize for that, but I couldn't really cut the section out. And finally, when we recorded this episode, Henry Kissinger was still alive, hence my jokes about that. But rest in piss. He is dead forever now. On with the episode.
Our first movie tells the story of a friendship behind prison walls that spans more than 20 years.
So welcome to episode 37 of Middlebrow Madness, an exercise in podcast hubris. My name is Derek Gade.
My name is Isabel Arf. Derek, I feel in my usual pursuit of all things ridiculous and terrible on the internet.
I mean, terrible, definitely.
Not always. Okay, not always terrible. The thing we're reading today, I actually have a lot of appreciation for.
Sure.
And I wanted, if anything, to preface it and be like, hey, The site I'm pulling this from is a good website. They seem to make good products. And I cut out all the informative bits of this blog post.
Are we returning?
Because it's
Are we returning to our once and future sponsor, Bad Dragon?
No. Bad Dragon is problematic, unfortunately.
Oh,
so,
I wasn't aware.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. It's too much to get into right now. Google listeners if you need to. Alas, they have no longer sponsors of the podcast.
I guess
even though
not,
I still
huh?
wear that hat all the time for moving because it's very useful to keep my hair out of the way. But no, we have a different toy maker. It's actually from Canada.
Oh,
they are a producer from the Great White North. And I don't even know how to start this exactly. Because I feel like if I just start saying the words, it will it'll come out of nowhere. So,
emphasis.
Are
on
you
come,
ready?
I bet.
Oh yeah. Emphasis more on some other parts of the body that might be erogenous zones in certain people's estimations.
Okay, the brain. I see.
I can credit this from one of my mutuals on Tumblr reblogging this description because they bought one of the toys and they found it very funny. So Derek. Mm-hmm. You're finally ready to take the plunge and start changing your whole forever, eh? The raw pussification power of the Mayor Maker has been transforming cunts around the world, gifting people with the most luscious, elongated mare pussies imaginable.
Whoa!
But which size...
Whoa! Time out! I'm going to need a clarification. Is this,
sure.
Is this Mayor M-A-Y-O-R, as in the leader of a small town? Or mare, M-A-R-E, like a horse?
The latter.
Aha. Uh-huh. Carry on.
But which size is right to get you started on your transformation? As the Mare Maker slips in more easily than other toys with similar max girths, we'll be breaking down the incredible ride that each size in the collection provides. Say goodbye to your hole as you knew it, because by the time the Mare Maker is through with you, it'll be unrecognizable. From a tight little pucker to a long, loose pussy of your dreams, welcome aboard.
Oh, man, whoever wrote the copy on this ate for days.
It gets better.
Holy shit.
I should also say the numbers that I am about to be saying, because all the items in the collection are like the Mare Maker 70, the Mare Maker, etc. That number is the max circumference in inches.
In inches?
In inches, but multiplied by 10.
Oh, okay.
That's a better way to say it. Yeah, okay. So.
All right.
The Merrymaker 70.
Hold on. So maybe this just shows the sort of discrepancy between our respective proclivities. But I'm not sure what the product is. Can I take a guess?
Go for it.
Is it like an inverse fleshlight?
It is an asymmetrical butt plug designed to essentially make your gape vertical instead of circular.
Oh my god. Carry on?
I'm sorry, Dad.
vertical gape.
I will say, this is the first time I have heard of this as a goal. So even like in the magical world that I live in, where a lot of this shit is pretty normal to me, this was new, which is why I think it tickled me so much.
I'm not even playing the same sport as y'all. I'm stunned. I didn't even know that was the thing that people was aiming for.
Neither did I, but hey, good for them. If they're having fun, you gotta
sure,
love it.
Go for it. Vertical gape away.
So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different sizes to choose from. Starts with 7 inches in circumference. Ends at guess how big it goes to in circumference, maximum circumference.
Ah, man, circumference. So I'm making an imaginary. Like, okay, so I know I'm gonna go with a flat 10.
It is 13.8.
13, oh boy, that's a lot.
For comparison, that means the diameter is 2.8 inches, the max diameter is actually not shown on here. The neck is I could do the math real quick, but the circumference is 35.1 centimeters. It's real big. It looks like a bomb.
It looks like a bomb.
I'm just gonna link you to the biggest one so you can see what this looks like.
Is there like a picture for scale?
Yes.
Okay.
There's
cool.
A human being in the picture. And there's also pictures with Coke cans.
I mean, the preview image is already kind of startling. Mayor Maker. Who's the mayor in this situation?
The person with the plug-in.
Oh, of course.
The idea is you're making your asshole into a horse pussy.
$309.
I mean, hey, that it's a specialized product.
Hey, you're right, but fuck, I could get a custom Scrabble board and then some for that amount of money.
Yeah, but that'd be difficult to put in your ass.
Difficult, but not impossible. So for the audience at home, it's kind of got the kind of size and shape. Well, you know what a butt plug looks like. We're all adults here. But it kind of looks like a Nerf football. It's smaller. It's smaller than like a regulation NFL football. But it does look like a decently sized Nerf football. It's big. I mean, it's comparable to the bigger fruits in the fruit aisle. Maybe not a watermelon, but it's definitely bigger than like a cantaloupe or a honeydew.
One of the actually useful information pieces that I cut out to make the funnier parts happen, and also because with the useful information, it's approximately 10 minutes to read, because I appreciate them quite a bit that they actually put in this amount of effort to be like, hey, here's what you might want to buy, and here's why.
The Coke can image is actually quite helpful, because it's literally, it's as tall as 2 just cans of Coke stacked together.
Yeah, and as wide as 2 as well, more or less.
Oh boy! All right, this is for the athletic sex haver.
The later, more useful information basically says, hey, the biggest one is once you're used to this, you can easily take 2 fists at once.
Holy moly!
Yeah, well, which is impressive.
Good practical knowledge, I guess.
Yeah. So can I tell you a little bit more about each size? Because I love the ad copy. Like, genuinely, I just appreciate the write-ups.
Please, go ahead.
So the Merrymaker 70. I will say these start a little less funny and get funnier as they go, because I think the person was having more fun as they wrote.
Bigger is better, I guess.
The Mayor Maker 70. You've arrived at Mayor Cunt Station, ready to embark on your pussification journey.
This is the second instance of pussification that we have in the copy so far.
The Mayor Maker 70 is a sleek plug that slips in easily, so if you're already taking toys like the Gatekeeper 65, which they also offer, you're ready for this one. This is a great long-term wear plug, and one to get you used to the intense feelings that the girth plus depth combo of the Mayor Maker collection is truly capable of. The Mayor Maker 85. As your hole slips over and around the Mayor Maker 85's oblong shape, you'll feel it giving way and starting to stretch out in a very different way to more symmetrical plugs. The extra tug on the ends of your hole is exactly what the Mayor Maker collection is all about. Your mayor pussy is already starting to form.
Mayor pussy. I want to tell the audience that as Isabel is reading this filth into my ears, Ruby, my little cat, has decided to just give me massive amounts of hugs. So I'm having a weird sort of cognitive moment right now.
I don't know how much of this is going to make it into the episode because it's we still have four more levels to go up to.
Holy shit, Isabel.
Yeah. The Mayor Maker 100. Time to level up. The Mayor Maker 100 is another 1.5 inch jump in girth and another inch in length that'll have you whinnying with bliss. Its oblong shape focuses the stretching power on the front and back of your lips, negating some of the pressure on your hip bones, which is nice. The shallower backside will nestle comfortably against your tailbone, but its huge pronounced front will absolutely juice your prostate like a lemon. Whether you're wearing it long term or riding it like a bucking bronco, rocking and popping your hole over its intense body to neck ratio, it's a hell of a ride. At this size, you're going to start visibly noticing your hole elongating and transforming, but your work isn't over yet. The 115. Whoa there, pony. The Mayor Maker 115 is where things start getting really serious. Your training is really going to start to show with this one. The sheer heft and girth increase of this plug is nothing to scoff at. I didn't think it was previous to scoff at, like, for any of the other ones, but
no,
hey.
This starts at 10.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it starts at 7, but or 7.
Starts at 7, yes. As it fills your hole out with a similar feeling to a thick, huge fist, that was a continuation of that other sentence.
Uh-huh.
If you're especially brave, rotating it around your hole will completely pulverize your prostate, which is, of all the things I want to happen to my prostate, that's not one of them,
Not one of the early round draft picks.
Now you can look back at your cunt in the mirror and revel in how much it has been transformed. But don't get too comfortable, Derek. You've got two more sizes to master before you can claim a real mare cunt.
It doesn't say Derek in the copy, I hope.
It doesn't, no.
Okay, cool.
The Mayor Maker 130. This is the second to last. You want to go big, so we're going to go big. The Mayor Maker 130 makes an intense marks an intense increase in mass and girth from the Mayor Maker 115. When taking it all the way, that pop of the flare dropping off will completely rearrange your insides.
Oh no.
At this point, your hull has been elongated and stretched out so beautifully, like a real mare's pussy just begging for fists and toys to plunge it without mercy. But if you're sitting here reading this while bouncing over the Mayor Maker 130 like it's nothing, then you're ready for the 138. So here it is.
Go to 140. 140 is too hardcore.
I mean, if you think about it, like each increase in circumference is such an increase in diameter because of how ratios work.
Uh-huh.
It's wild. So this is the apex of the Mayor Maker collection. Let's face it. At this point, your cunt has already been stretched and transformed beyond recognition. So what have you got to lose? Well, your tightness, that's for sure. But that's why you're here. That's what got you to this point. The unending hunt for a luscious, drooping, elongated pussy that no top could ever resist shoving themselves into at first sight. The Mayor Maker 138 is an incredibly aspirational plug, and the kind of plug that once conquered becomes the talk of your circles. This is the toy you're destined to take.
So I like that this part of the copy treats the 138 as like a gag. It's like no one really would go to this point, but it's there if you want it. There was so much finality in the copy for the next to last one, and this one is just like if you're a total sicko, there's this one. But like,
I mean, the thing is, I'm sure that people requested the bigger one. Like, I know people well enough that no matter how big of a toy you make, someone is going to be like, hey, can I get a bigger one? Which, in a lot of ways, is inspiring.
But at some
like,
point,
imagine having that kind of dedication to your butthole.
I mean, I try to treat my butthole okay, but like...
We do this podcast less than these people treat their butthole. And that's great.
But I feel,
I'm so happy for them.
I feel that you get to a point where it becomes like existential questions am I just getting at a point where I risk rupturing something very important?
I think you just got to listen to your body at that point. Go slow, and the world is your oyster. Your asshole is the world's oyster. Something along those lines.
Man.
I'm so happy I found that copy. It made me so happy when I read
That's
it for the first time.
A wild thing.
Because I will say, I cut out over half of it, because the other half of it is actually helpful. Like useful.
Like, here's how you lube it up. Here's how you kind of mount this fucking thing.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, here's like comparison points. Here's, if you're used to this, this might be a good size. If you're not used to this, go with this one. Here's some ways to use it, that kind of thing. This one's approximately the size of this fist, this other fist, like all this stuff. It's great work from Canada, is what I want to say. So movies.
every time it's like,
to be fair, I'm sure there's a movie of people using these. I'm sure we can watch that movie somewhere.
I'm sure that's easily findable. I'm sure that within the hour we could find someone using this thing.
And absolutely.
I don't know that we would have to trial that hard, honestly. But I ain't got no OnlyFans account, so maybe it'll be more difficult for me.
I just Googled because now I want to know.
Of course.
You know what? I don't have time to look up porn, Derek. We're talking about traditional films that generally don't have gaping assholes in them,
that's
unfortunately.
Right. So... Yeah, unless we're dealing with, like, a particularly avant-garde piece of shock, transgressive shock cinema, we're probably not going to be in the realm of gaping assholes very much. And I can't think of many things that are more antithetical to avant-garde transgressive shock cinema than the IMDb top 250 list. And how's it that for a fucking segue?
You're like Jackie Chan buying segues left and right.
So, Male Brown Madness is nominally a movie... Well, no, it's not nominally a movie podcast. It is a movie
It podcast. Is a movie podcast. It's just because we spent 16 minutes reading copy for a butt plug with some unique characteristics.
You spent 16 minutes reading ad copy. Well, not ad copy, but you spent 16 minutes reading copy for a oblong butt plug or whatever.
We spent 60 minutes experiencing it together, Derek.
That's true. So this is what I was going to say. Every time you bring something to the table, it's always something that's wild on one level or another. The transition into the actual show, it's like, I have to imagine that part of your order of operations for finding material to read is, how can I make the transition from this to the actual show the hardest it can possibly be?
I will say... This was Derek's fault. I gave him three options. To be fair, I was a little vague with them, but the options were contemporary politics, funny sex words, or a possibly unwell person in their conspiracy theory. And this is the one Derek chose. So, yeah. Audience, you can thank the actually normal host of this podcast for that.
I will say that this is probably the least of a bummer of the three, and for that, I think I made the right choice.
I think the politics one actually pretty fucking funny, but I'll save it for later.
Maybe we'll hear it another time. But for now, the show itself. So what do we do here other than listen to... other than talk about gaping assholes for nearly half an hour? We talk about movies, specifically the IMDb Top 250 circa August 2018. It's a long story. So the idea is that we take these 250 movies, we add six of our own ringers, and we put them in a beautiful 256 seed bracket, and one by one we observe each matchup, We decide which movie is better until we get to a point where we crown a single movie the best movie of all time, asterisk. We are past the halfway point of round one. There's a lot of heavy hitters yet to come. Fuck, what did I see? And it was like sort of a super duper bummer double feature. Not unlike one of the ones that we have today, involving a movie that I have not yet had the pleasure to see. Yet that has
was it Come and See versus something?
Yes, it's whoever Come and See it has in round one. It is Taxi Driver. Yay!
Oh, wow. Fascinating.
Yeah, but we're not talking about those two movies today. We've got four movies to talk about today. That's two matchups. The winners of each of these matchups will be paired together in round two, whenever the fuck we get to that. So
we're working our way towards there.
A little bit at a time. This is like we are slowly moving a mountain, one pailful of sand at a time.
Like my favorite Crowbar song. That's a hilarious joke for all the sludge metal fans out there.
I mean, I like sludge metal, but I'm not sure that I'm familiar with the work of Crowbar.
You should listen to their album Sonic Excess in its purest form, which is also just a fucking great title.
It's a good title.
A wonderful album. That's Isabel's recommendation for today. perfect music to listen to while you're pussifying your asshole.
Oh, boy.
Probably. I don't know.
I'm gonna have a field day picking a title for this episode. All right, let's get to it. We've got two matchups. Two interesting matchups, I would say. First off, the 92 seed Toy Story, released in 1995, directed by John Lasseter, written by Joss Whedon, Andrew Stanton, Joel Cohen, and Alex Soklow.
Not the Joel Cohen you're thinking of.
Yeah, different Joel Cohen, yeah.
I got so thrown when I first saw that in the opening credits, and then I Googled, and I'm glad I Googled, because otherwise I would have looked like a right fool on this podcast.
It should be illegal that there's a different Joel Cohen and a guy named Ethan Cohen and not Ethan Cohen.
Yes.
So starring Tom Hanks, Tim Allen, Laurie Metcalf, Annie Potts, John Ratzenberger, Don Rickles, Wallace Shawn, and Jim Varney. Let's see. What are we looking at here? Yes, the budget. $30 million in 1995 bucks, and it made back $394.4 million at the box office. I'm going to look at its accolades real quick. So, fun fact, this 1995 is well before the Best Animated Film Oscar. So, not really an Oscar player, Toy Story was. But, let's see. What did it get? It was nominated for Best Original Screenplay, which it lost. Randy Newman double nominated for Original Score and Original Song, lost both, which is insane. But it did get a special achievement Oscar, because it was pretty groundbreaking from a technical point of view in the year of our Lord, 1995.
It was the first entirely computer-generated feature animated film.
That's exactly it. Versus the movie that might be the exact opposite of Toy Story, The Deer Hunter. This is absurd. What the fuck are we doing here?
They both have enlisted men in them.
That's true.
Just because some of those enlisted men are plastic does not mean you should discount their service, Derek.
That is very true. Shout out to Arlie Ermy, yeah. He plays a little army man guy. The Deer Hunter, released in 1978. Directed by Michael Cimino, with a screenplay by Derek Washburn. It also says here that Michael Cimino is uncredited on the screenplay. Starring Robert De Niro, John Cazale, John Savage, Meryl Streep, and Christopher Walken. $15 million budget in 1978 bucks, made $49 million. So kind of a modest hit. And this one was indeed an Oscar player. I believe it was a winner for of five Academy Awards. Yes, and nominated for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Winning Best Picture, Best Director for Michael Cimino, Best Supporting Actor for Christopher Walken, Best Editing, and Best Sound. So we get to talk about Tom Hanks again.
We should start out with a quick summary of Toy Story. Me and Derek discussed we're terrible at doing this.
We are.
So long story short, history's greatest monster, Tom Hanks... he plays Woody, who is a toy cowboy. I mean, it's fitting that Tom Hanks' fascist tendencies come to the forefront again through his embodiment of a dictatorial law enforcement officer. Plays Sheriff Woody, and he's a toy, as you might have guessed from the title of the film. And toys are alive in this universe. I feel so dumb, like, talking about the plot of Toy Story, but toys are alive. I really want to get through the Toy Story summary. And one day, for his birthday, their owner, is it Alan? Andy. you start with an A. Andy gets a new toy. His name is Buzz Lightyear. He's played by history's greatest hero, Tim the Toolman Taylor.
It's Tim Allen, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's forever in my heart, Tim the Toolman Taylor. I don't quite know. I'll be honest, I'm kind of just freewheeling it, freeballing it. It's not the right word. Derek, I'm very tired. It was Black Friday today.
It sure was.
So, history's greatest hero, in contrast, Tim Allen comes in as that beautiful toy of Buzz Lightyear. He thinks he's a real spaceman. He is not. This is a twist. For him, not for the audience. We know already. He's going to learn it later. He accidentally falls out of the window through some machinations of that evil man, Tom Hanks. And Tom Hanks, his friends all turn on him. And they have to go on a journey to find each other and themselves, Tom and Tim, in the wide world of suburbia. Eventually, they end up back together in Andy's new house. Some things happen in the middle. Is that fair? Did I fairly go through the plot?
I mean, fairly, I don't know, but I think that's like the broad strokes of it, yeah.
One toy hits another toy, and they both they learn more about themselves. Eventually, Buzz Lightyear learns that he's not actually a real spaceman. He is a toy spaceman.
But is cool.
It is fine, because just because he's a toy doesn't mean he can't be a hero.
Oh my god. Okay. So, yes, broadly, that is what it is. So, Toy Story, last I watched it, I was struck by... Okay, so let's lay our cards out on the table. So, Isabel Arf, known Pixar hater. I'm going to go ahead and guess that you're not crazy about this movie.
I used to be more into it. I feel like every time I've watched it as an adult, I've liked it less and less.
Okay.
Now it is a firmly 2.5-star movie. Some solid bits, some solid goofs and gags. I think that Tim Allen is very funny in it. He's got that kind of Galaxy Quest energy, like the cocky asshole, mm-hmm. which I think he plays very well. And I think Jim Varney, hilarious. We should have watched Ernest Goes to Jail. That's a funny fucking film. It's better than Toy Story.
See, I don't know about that. That seems like one of those patented Isabel Arf hot takes.
I will say Ernest Goes to Jail is, I think, the most popularly acclaimed one. Ernest Goes to Jail.
I will trust you on that one.
You should watch the Ernest films. Not all of them. Ernest Goes to Africa, maybe skip, because that one's a little bit not dicey. Exactly what you want. But and the first one's not great either, but Ernest Goes to Jail, highly recommended. And Ernest Scared Stupid, pretty darn funny too.
Is Ernest Goes to Jail the one where Jim Varney plays a double role?
Yes, and he's like really, he's great in it. I love Jim Varney, like genuinely. Like, I think he's really funny. I think he can be a very good dramatic actor in the few roles he's had that were a little more dramatic. And I mean, Ernest gets electricity powers. It's radical.
So I will do the yeoman's work and try to defend Toy Story. I think this movie's pretty good. So first of all, yes, there's kind of like the technical aspect, which it's kind of, I think that for a movie that was entirely digitally made on old ass computers in 1995, this movie still looks pretty good.
It does. Because I think they chose the right subject.
They had the good sense to be like, everything that we animate is going to look plasticky as hell. So why not make our story about toys? And I always liked Toy Story, yes, for the performances. I do like Tim Allen's performance. It does have that Galaxy Quest energy. I like Tom Hanks in this movie playing a giant asshole.
I will say I do agree with that. Like, even though I think he's an evil, corrupt, and terrible man, I will say he's very, very funny when he plays just a giant dick. I think it's one of my favorite versions of Tom Hanks.
And it's not a vein that gets mined a lot, but it's a mine that it's a vein that should be mined more because he's good at it. I like the movie. I should note, I really like Randy Newman's songs in this movie.
It's Randy Newman. I fucking love Randy Newman.
Beyond You've Got a Friend in Me, which is insane that it lost Best Original Song that year.
Yeah.
Because I guarantee you that the other nominees in that category have not held up. I don't even have to look them up. I'm not gonna.
You've seen Joe versus the Volcano, right?
I have not.
Oh.
Another Tom Hanks movie.
That is, if we're gonna make any Tom Hanks movie canonical, I'm kind of leaning towards that one, I'll be honest.
That one has its cult.
And also, weirdly, directed by John Patrick Shanley?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great work.
One movie that would be interested in your take on is Bonfire of the Vanities.
I have really wanted to see it for a while, but have never gotten to it. But the poster looks a lot like the poster for Nothing But Trouble, and that's a great film. It's a unique film, and I think that is my favorite thing in movies, is like, I haven't seen this anywhere else before. I think that Nothing But Trouble might be one of the most aesthetically upsetting films I've ever seen, and I think that that's beautiful.
We like to throw the word sicko around. Dan Aykroyd is a sicko.
Absolutely. That
dude is a total pervert.
You've seen the commercial he did for his Crystal Skull vodka, right? Where he says it's good because there's ghosts inside of it?
No.
Everyone, this is your homework for the podcast. Go pause the podcast, go to YouTube, and look up Dan Aykroyd Crystal Skull vodka. There's like a 20 or something minute long like ad he did for it, going in depth into how exactly he developed his whole Crystal Skull vodka thing. And part of it is that he had like haunted diamonds or something that they filter it through. I don't remember the exact wording, but it's delightful. He is a weirdo in one of the best ways.
That dude got his dick sucked by a ghost in a movie for kids.
We should all be so lucky.
Daddy, what are you doing?
And he was in Dragnet.
And now we're talking about Dan Aykroyd when we should be talking about Toy Story, but like the thing I love the most about Dan Aykroyd is not that he's a fucking ghost pervert, but that he absolutely and completely totally reps the tragically hip. He loves the hip almost as much as I do.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, like,
good for him.
Like in the mid 90s, he like managed to convince people at Saturday Night Live to be like, you know, there's this band up in Canada that no American has ever heard of, and I would like them to be the guests for the show. And they were.
That's like the Canadian nerd version of how, Belushi got Fear, the punk band, to play.
That's exactly it. Except the Tragically Hip were not banned from the show.
Yes.
Toy Story. When I rewatched this movie, I was very surprised to find out how much of a narrative bullet it was. There's like no excess baggage on it. It kind of like flew by. It's like 80 something minutes, which I always appreciate in the movie. I do think, like macro level, I do think that Woody and Buzz are very well characterized, and I really like watching Toy Story through the lens of, so this is a story about a man of reason being set upon by a man of faith.
Okay.
That was always kind of my favorite reading of it, where Woody is the man of reason. It's like, you know, the guy, glad-hander. It's like, you know, no nonsense is his business. And here comes this fucking, this fucking space case, like Harsh and My Mellow. And ultimately they get past their differences. And I don't know. I think it's not like earth-shatteringly original storytelling, but I think it's very solid storytelling. And oddly, for a movie of this ilk, I think the action sequences are pretty good.
They're solid, yeah.
the last big chase with the RC car, the like 20 seconds where Woody pinballs in the back of a Datsun, I think. The whole scene with the aliens is like, I think this is like a pretty good
movie. Okay. It's fine. I like 2.5 stars is not bad. It's exactly median. Down the middle.
See, this is the thing for me. Something that would be right down the middle would be a 3. So 2.5 is like would be slightly less than that. So this is why stars is like an imperfect metric. I have it as a 4. I think if you're going to have a children's film of the era, you could do like this is like top shelf.
I would have to look into that claim more before I could dispute it. but I would love to try sometime.
I mean, what's Don Bluth doing? Let's think of the Kings. What's Ghibli doing in the mid-90s? They're putting out Whisper. So 95 is Whisper of the Heart, which is fucking fantastic. And is, for the record, for me, better than Toy Story. So that's one.
Okay.
95, what's Don Bluth putting out around that time? I believe Thumbelina is 94? Am I wrong?
I have on Letterboxd the family film page for 1995. Uh-huh. Here's some films that I think are a little better. Jumanji. I would prefer to watch Jumanji. I'll be totally honest. I like Jumanji.
I like Toy Story better.
What about Babe?
I would have to watch Babe again to give it a fair shake because I've not seen that in a very long time.
To be fair, it's no Babe 2 Pig in the City, which I think is a better film, but I still quite like Babe quite a bit.
George Miller.
Let's see. I'm looking through this list. Slam Dunk Ernest.
Pass.
There was a movie that I remember basically nothing about. I watched it more than once as a kid. I think it was my mom fucking hated it. Called Gordy, which was the other talking pig movie of that year.
I have no idea what the fuck this is.
It's a talking pig that, like, in my brain, what I remembered, I have thought about Gordy recently, unfortunately. In my brain, I remembered that he helped, like, get someone elected or something. This is not true. There's, as far as I can find on the internet, no politicians involved.
So this is like Babe's exploitation.
More or less, but it came out the same year. Also, I will be honest, Gordy's a better name for a pig. That's the one thing I will give it. Besides, Man of the House, not a good movie. I don't know why I'm even bringing that one up. Boy, howdy, pickings are slim that year. Okay, you might be correct.
So I think for me, it's like Whisper of the Heart, if you're like, if you've got sort of like a whimsical child or like a child with eyes full of wonder, go for Whisper of the Heart. But if you've got like sort of your box,
if your child's a normie,
if your child's a normie, yeah, if your child's a normie, just pop in fucking Toy Story. Toy Story is a great movie. I like Toy Story, but Whisper of the Heart is number one with a bullet for me.
The one thing we didn't get to in my notes on Toy Story is a note that I'm just going to read verbatim what I wrote when I was watching the film. With the RC car, the concept of being a sentient toy with a remote control that completely overrides your free will is both existentially terrifying and about half of the horny posts trans girls on Tumblr make.
That is the most Isabel Arf thing I've ever heard you fucking say.
I'm not saying my horny posts, but I am saying I know a lot of trans girls. The end of sentence.
What are these girls' take on the spooky sort of Franken toys in the third act?
I mean, they're goth weirdos, so they're into them. To be fair, I'm also into them. I think they're neat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that scared the shit of me when I was a kid. But like, I really like that they were written as like sort of a community of creatures. So now we have to talk about the deer hunter in the room, which is the deer hunter. Oh man! So we transitioned from a movie with quips and color and life and songs by Randy Newman to this Russian-American dirge about the complete and total moral failure of America's involvement in Vietnam and how it broke everyone, like either directly or by proxy, and how fucking America sucks ass and how closure is fake. And
to be fair, that does sound pretty apt to Randy Newman in the 70s, the songs he was writing then.
I mean, yes, this is closer to
but
like
less
the,
funny.
Oh yeah. This is like the opposite of a funny movie. This movie is dead serious. And it is dead serious from end to end. It is even dead serious metatextually. Because you've got John Cazale in the middle of it with Meryl Streep.
That's and this is his sad. Last role as well, right?
This is the last one. This is the fifth of five. The perfect filmography for an actor. This was the capstone. I'm really interested in your take. Because you're a lot more sort of politically minded than I am. Not that I'm an idiot. But you're way smarter about these things than I am.
I mean, I think you're selling yourself short.
My interest in the Deer Hunter specifically now against Toy Story is a much more sort of macro meta idea of what is good and what is good for this competition that we're engaging in. But that I'm getting way ahead of myself. So let's talk about this movie.
Do you want to do the plot synopsis?
Let's try to condense this because
it's essentially in three parts.
At first, so Robert De Niro. So it's this community in, I believe it's in
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. It's a wedding, so there is kind of like a boisterousness, and this is like you're setting up the community, you're setting up the relationships, at the risk of being like too vague. How about this? I'll just read the first paragraph of the Wikipedia summary.
Fair.
There's no, because this is a dense thing.
Yes.
It's about a trio of Slavic American steelworkers whose lives were upended after fighting in the Vietnam War. The three soldiers are portrayed by Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken and John Savage, with John Cazale in his final role, Meryl Streep, blah, 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 blah. So the first act is a wedding. The second act, which is probably the is the second or third act more harrowing? I'm not sure. So the second one is the war in Vietnam. And the third one is the PTSD act, as it were. So basically, the steelworkers have their lives appended, go fight under the flag, and get fucked up in every conceivable way. Physical, emotional, mental, and has one of the great bummer endings and is like kind of a capstone on a decade of great bummer, a great American bummer cinema. I'm not going to spoil it, but it is very, to use an overused word, iconic. And it caused a lot of hubbub back in 1978. Let's put it that way. That might have been too vague.
I think it gives the general outline of it, because there's a lot of characters, there's a lot of relationships, and we're not going to get into all of them because it would take fucking forever, and we already spent fucking 20 minutes talking about buttholes. So,
right.
I will say, of the three kind of partitions, I think the Vietnam one is the weakest by a pretty large margin.
As far as like filmmaking and storytelling goes, I would probably agree.
And I think also the acting is not good. I think that
okay.
John Savage in the Vietnam part is bad.
Okay.
Like straight up. I also think he's kind of the weakest part of the film in general, but you know, when you're acting against Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro, that's a little rough.
Yeah, that's like, you know, there's gotta be a third, but
I think that the first part is genuinely really evocative, and it very much gets you in the sense of, okay, this is what this town is. This is how these people interact. I'm understanding what their relationships are. I'm understanding that they're all going to make a lot of bad decisions because they feel like it's what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Both as Americans and as men in the broader sense. Yes. This and Barry Lyndon are kind of tied in a lot of ways, which we're getting to Barry Lyndon later in the episode, in that they're kind of one much funnier than the other one, but they're both about how, like, trying to be what society deems a man is will probably fuck you up a little bit. Or a lot of bit.
A lot of it.
Yeah. I think that on a filmmaking level, I really do enjoy the first and last parts. And the favorite part of it for me is De Niro coming back home and skipping his, like, welcome back party. And just being in that hotel alone, and there's some great acting there, and it's the the way, without ever really directly saying exactly why he's skipping it, it's clear that what's going on in his brain is that what they expect him to be is not something he can be, and he doesn't know how to handle that, and he doesn't know how to address that with them yet, and might never be able to, and he almost doesn't even know what to say to anyone. It's a very well-done scene. I will say, I think the parts with Steven, who is John Savage, in the third act, kind of suck. I get what they're doing in the general sense. I get where they're going for, or what they're going for, but I think it's just pretty weak, and that the central conflict feels like yes, it is not good to have both your legs amputated, but he's still alive. He still has a wife that loves him and would like him to be better, and to come back home. And again, it is that kind of his sense of being a man and like being able to provide is no longer there. And that's clearly bothering him. He can't be what he was. He won't no longer fits into the community. And I get that, but it's also frustrating and annoying to me. Unfortunately, it's similar to how we talked about a little bit with Raging Bull, where like I get what it's doing, but also I find this character so annoying to be around that it makes it difficult to like internalize it in the same way to me.
So you're not big on the sort of very internal, gruff, tortured masculinity?
Not generally, no.
Okay.
I like it when it's pushed outwards and made a little bit more outwardly violent. Like, I like Taxi Driver quite a bit, but we'll get there. And I also like Walken in this movie, who...
Walken is astonishing.
Yes. He's genuinely amazing. I also wrote down my notes. Young Christopher Walken, kind of nice with it, not going to lie. So
Walken was always really unique looking, even when he was younger.
Yeah. But I want to get your take before I get to this stuff that I'm going to shit on a little bit. Oh, also I have the note, finally a movie where drunk driving on your wedding night is cool.
I am a bit more amenable to tales of rumpled masculinity, which may explain my fondness for Raging Bull, which might explain my fondness for this movie. I think my preferred portion of the film is the setup. And maybe that's just because it's like the least downer of the three, but I also think it does a really good job narratively of setting everything up, and it does so in a fairly organic way. The Nam stuff is really dicey. Yeah. It's like I understand like creative license, and I understand that no one's out here playing Russian roulette with POWs, and it's like, I don't know, man, seems rough. I'll say it this way. Michael Cimino does not strike me as the most racially sensitive director that America's ever produced.
Yeah, yeah.
Y'all ever seen a movie called Year of the Dragon? Holy shit. There's also another reason why Heaven's Gate is better than this movie. I think, Walken and De Niro, though, are just so completely, totally undeniable. And there's when people talk about this movie, they'll talk about the last Russian roulette scene. And that shit is like heartbreaking and terrifying at the same time. And it's, pardon the pun, explosive coda to this just emotionally devastating piece of work. But it's like, I think this movie is good. I don't know that everything hangs together in the way that it should. Here's a take that I'm just going to throw out. Would this movie be better if they just completely excised the Vietnam part?
I personally think so. I think that gets around a lot of my problems with it. It makes it a little... You can spend a little bit more time in the first and last parts as well. I'm not necessarily saying it shouldn't be 3 hours, because I think that it's generally used pretty well. Yes. It never feels slack. It never feels like, oh, what's this scene doing here? Like, I get what they're doing with every scene. It's not pointless. But I want a little more room to breathe with some of the characters, both before and afterwards. And I think that by cutting out that Vietnam section, you will get more of, or the audience would get much more of what the people that they come home to experience. Like, they know what it was like when they, before they left, and now they're seeing these people coming back completely changed. Having to, like, kind of imagine that and just eliding the middle part there, I think would be more effective. Personally, I will say that I do like the, it's very simple filmmaking thing, but skipping directly from the last night in town to deep when they're already in Vietnam. It's not like, oh, we just got here or we're on our first mission or something. Right. Like, they've been there clearly for weeks, if not months. It's a simple filmmaking thing, but there's a lot of people, fucking Forrest Gump, for example, where they really want to show you, hey, here's what boot camp was like. Here's what the first couple, like, weeks were like in Vietnam. It's like, no, cut that. It's not important. Just go straight to where we actually need to pick up.
Straight to the shit.
Yes. But I do personally agree that I think it'd be more effective to just skip that part entirely.
So, Steven Soderbergh, I know you listen to our podcast. We need a non-Vietnam cut of a Deer Hunter, please.
I think the only part that would be difficult is setting up the Russian roulette thing. But yes. I think you could have a line or two that could kind of paper over that.
Or like a flashback.
Yeah.
You don't completely cut it out. I mean, like, I feel weird. It's like, you know, this movie is like sort of, I mean, it's on this list and it's like acknowledged as like an all-time classic. It's like, I think this movie would be better like this. But so I should also point out that I do like the deer hunting scene, not just because, like, hey, it's the thing. But I do think it does a good job. I think it is the part outside the wedding that does what the wedding does. That does what the wedding does at almost that level.
Yes, agreed.
It's just dudes. They're hanging out, and it's all just, they're just talking, and there's like a little bit of action, but it's very internal. And there's like a couple of, pardon the pun again, explosive outbursts here, but used more for color. And it's really like in stark contrast to the, I don't want to use this word, but I'm going to use it anyway because I feel like it encompasses a lot of the feeling, the hysterical nature of a lot of the acting and a lot of the performances in the second act.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that it also is really good at setting up both the relations between these specific characters, but also how, like, I hate to keep coming back to this angle, but how, like, men interact in this town and what is expected as a normal interaction, which involves some amount of violence, like, and involves aggression towards each other. It's never just, like, chill. There's always that kind of feeling.
This movie is the opposite of chill.
Yeah, there's always kind of that feeling that something might explode or someone might just kind of say the wrong thing and something could go completely off the rails. And I think that that is a really excellent way to get that kind of characterization and cultural characterization without just shoving it in your face. I'm kind of repeating things people have said before, but the way that the movie, like, when it's in Vietnam specifically, focuses so much on the American side, which of course it's like an American Vietnam movie. It just kind of happens that way. Which I think is its own kind of tragedy. Like, I wish we had more movies like The Thin Red Line, which it's fucking tragic that's not on this list, where there's more of the, like, a little bit of both sides of the conflict, or the two Iwo Jima movies that Clint Eastwood made. That are genuinely excellent and I think kind of have to be seen together. And I think is one of the best ways to do that kind of a war movie, because otherwise you are inherently setting up the other side of the war as almost cartoons in certain ways, or just generic people without, like, non-people, like just cardboard cutouts that you're going to shoot at and that are evil. And I think this movie, by focusing entirely on these American soldiers and their experience in this one POW camp, because we see nothing else of Vietnam, you kind of get the impression that Vietnamese soldiers are like almost like monsters and animals. Like, they right. never do anything even remotely human. They're just sadistic and cruel for no reason.
And this movie got shit for that in 1978 when it came out.
Yes, and I think deservedly so. I think it's by far the weakest part of the film.
1,000%.
And yeah, and it's also just comes off as the, like, I think the better, like, Vietnam movies, because there's quite a few, even quite a few on this list. I think the better ones show that it was a bad idea to go there in the first place. We never should have been there. It was a terrible war to start. It was a war of aggression by America. And there's no reason for people on both sides to needlessly die for this incredibly, stop the dominoes from falling to communism. This movie instead comes across much more as it reminds me of the center-right critiques of Iraq, where the problem isn't we went to war. The problem is we didn't do the war the right way. We should have cared more about the troops. We should have, executed this war better. And I disagree. I think that the Vietnam War never should have taken place, personally.
You heard it here first, folks.
And Henry Kissinger, the fact that he's still alive is one of... God, it fucking sucks, man. He should have been killed in the womb. His mother should have aborted him. No offense to Henry Kissinger, but kill yourself. He's 100. He can do it.
So yeah, so I... Okay. So with all those caveats, I do think that The Deer Hunter is marginally the better movie of the two. But I also know that The Deer Hunter is The Deer Hunter. And I also know, peeking ahead just a little bit, that there's a non-zero chance that it goes up against another 3-hour 70s behemoth in round two. And I know that there's precedent for this earlier in the bracket. So I put it to you, Isabel. I think we are in agreement that The Deer Hunter is the better movie.
Yes, I think I would agree with that. I think that when it's good, it's pretty great.
I would also put it to you.
It's going to lose no matter what?
Not that it's going to lose no matter what, although I think you may be right in that. I think you're right in your assessment that it might lose to either one of these movies we're going to talk about next. But my point is that I think that you would also agree with me that The Deer Hunter is not the greatest film of all time, asterisk.
I would definitely agree with that.
So here's what I propose. I move that we put the breezy 83-minute children's movie into round two and offer it up as a sacrifice to two superior movies. Or, if you insist, because I know you might have a lot to say about this movie, what I'm saying is I will vote with you.
Agree with you. I think watching The Deer Hunter twice in my life is enough. I'm good. I don't need a third go around. And I think that with either one, I am kind of running out of things to say about both of them, I'll be honest. I think if I really went deep, I would have some things to say about The Deer Hunter, sure. But not that much. And not enough to justify moving it to the next round when I would on any average day much prefer to put on Toy Story and kind of half watch it while I play Pokemon. That's how hard I work.
Toy Story wins. Not necessarily because it's a better movie, but because it's the easier watch. This is my existential thing about what is good. Does good mean watchable? Does good mean dense? What does good mean? So there's different flavors of good. So we're deciding to move one particular flavor of good ahead. So congratulations to Toy Story. Commiserations to Michael Cimino, who has no movies on this list other than this one.
Yeah, wow. That is kind of... I'm surprised that... what's it called? God.
Heaven's Gate is a four-heads-only movie. I feel that's not a IMDb top 250 movie.
My brain knew it was Heaven's Gate, but I just kept thinking, not like The Cult. Not like The Cult, right? Not like The Cult. Yeah.
Exactly
like The Cult. Right, I think about the Heaven's Gate cult a lot more than the film, I'll be honest.
I don't think about neither, but I think about the movie more. All right, so Toy Story is victorious and now waits in the wings to see which movie it will face, and it's a couple of fucking titans. In our next matchup, we have the 37 seed, Casablanca, released in 1942, directed by Michael Curtiz, the screenplay by Julius J. Epstein, Philip G. Epstein, and Howard Koch, based on Everybody Comes to Rick's by Murray Burnett and Joan Allison, starring Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, Paul Henreid, Claude Rains, Conrad Veidt, Sidney Greenstreet, and Peter Lorre. That is an old school fucking all-star team.
Yeah.
Estimates of the budget range between $878,000 to $1 million in 1942 bucks. It made 3.7 to 6.9. Numbers differ. So that is, you know, modest hit. Famously not super duper, like, well-liked. Kind of tepidly received back when it came out. Was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, winning 3 Best Picture, Best Director for Michael Curtiz, and Best Screenplay for Epstein, Epstein, and Koch. And despite being kind of tepidly released, generally accepted to be one of the great American movies of the first half of the 20th century. Some would say one of the greatest movies of all time. Versus the 220 seed Barry Lyndon, released in 1975. Written and directed by one Stanley Kubrick, starring Ryan O'Neill, Marissa Berenson, Patrick McGee, Hardy Krueger, Diana Corner, and Gay Hamilton. This is based on The Luck of Barry Lyndon by William Makepeace Thackeray. $11 million budget, which is insane. $31.5 million take, which is also insane because this means that this movie made its money back and then some. And as far as awards and nominations go, this was kind of an Oscar player, nominated for 7 Academy Awards, winning 4, mostly below the line stuff. So you got art direction, costume design, cinematography, and best score. The only person nominated to not win anything for Barry Lyndon is one Stanley Kubrick, who lost best picture, best director, and best adapted screenplay. But to be fair, 1975 might be the most stacked year in Oscar history. So, let's talk about Casablanca.
Yeah, let's. I will say I am with Keenan Ivory Wayans and the Glimmer Man on this one, and that's a pretty darn good movie.
Okay. I have not seen the Glimmer Man.
No one needs to, but you should maybe. I don't know. If you're the kind of person who's like, yeah, I want to watch The Glimmer Man, you should definitely watch The Glimmer Man. If you're the kind of person who's like, I have no interest in watching the fucking Glimmer Man, you're good. Your life will be fine without it. You should watch, what's his like passion project movie, Seagal's? On Deadly Ground.
I was going to say, is it Under Siege? No, it's on Deadly Ground.
Yes, which yes, he co-directed. Or I believe actually main directed, and it has Michael Caine in it, and Arlie Ermey, funny enough, and Billy Bob Thornton.
That guy keeps showing up.
Steven Seagal, terrible person, but On Deadly Ground, fun movie. Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, fun movie. The Glimmer Man, fun movie. I'll be honest, he stopped making good movies after that, but hey.
Did you see Exit Wounds with DMX?
I did. It sucked. and then he did that.
Isabel?
sorry. He did the vampire movie, which is one of the few movies I've turned off because it was so bad. I've watched some vampire fucking movie. Trash. It's called Against the Dark.
I have no idea what this
it's
is.
It's real. It's real bad. Or maybe it gets better. I don't know. I turned it off after 20 minutes, which I never do. I like making myself suffer with films. And even I was like,
you're watching turkeys.
Yeah. I watched all of movie 43.
So did I. Not good. Yeah. That might be the worst movie I've ever seen.
It's up there. It's definitely up there. Is that the...
but we're not talking about...
Sorry, just... was that the one with Adrian Brody, or is that the... Was he in the other one?
I think he's in the other one, but he might be in this comedy. One, too.
Yes.
Yeah, from the... That's the ShamWow guy, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, Adrian Brody's in that. Unfortunately, not reprising his Rastaman character, but, you know, hey. That got him permanently banned from SNL.
Man. Everyone's in movie 43, though. Let me just do a quick control F Adrian. Nope, he's not in it. That's Academy Award winner, Adrian Brody.
So Casablanca.
Isabel.
I'm sorry.
I don't know if you hang out with some of the same people that I do, but sometimes people come up to me and say, Derek, what's an old movie? It's like, well, you know, you got to watch like Citizen Kane. It's like, not that old. I don't watch no black and white movies. It's like, you're insane. That's an insane take for a human being to have.
A surprisingly common one, though. I've heard it a number of times. I agree.
This isn't even like a four heads only thing. If you watch movies with any amount of like regularity or interest, I mean, you're going to be watching some movies from like before the 1960s, right? I mean, most movies were in black and white before that. And a lot of them are really fucking good, and Casablanca is one of them. So anytime someone is like, I don't like black and white movies, like, you sit your ass down and you watch Casablanca because that's a fucking movie.
And it's incredibly entertaining. I think it's like the best part about getting people to like sit down and watch it is like, yes, it's in black and white. So you think it's going to be, I think the perception is, oh, it's gonna be boring. It's gonna be like an old movie. It's gonna be boring. Nothing's gonna happen in it. A, not boring. A lot of shit fucking happens in it. There's Nazis. There's like Humphrey Bogart. There's Ingrid Bergman. There's love and drama and the war. And it's genuinely like gripping filmmaking.
There is deep, deep melancholy.
Yes. And it's just beautifully made, beautifully acted, beautifully directed. It's, I feel sort of silly saying that Casablanca, fucking great movie, because obviously it is, but sure. Casablanca, fucking great movie.
Hey, you're into like social justice shit. You're like 23 and into social justice shit. This is a resistance movie. Get your shit together.
And I think like a genuinely affecting one. Like, I think the way that it positions what resistance looks like and what it needs to be and the how necessary it is, even if you think it's futile, and how giving up just isn't an ethical option, really, that there's still joy and passion in the struggle for something you know is right and something invigorating in it, that there's not... I don't want to say hope, because I think hope is like a word that can be misused a lot and can be used to sidestep responsibility, but I think there's a determination in it that is, like, it's very moving, and like brought a tear to my eye more than once, both with the beautiful romance, which is genuinely also wonderful, and then the political stuff. Fucking Derek, it's Casablanca. Should we tell people what the plot of Casablanca is?
Yes. And just to sort of tack on to what you were saying, this is a movie about no matter how much you try to stay outside of politics, you are part of politics, buddy. So fucking... so fucking shape up and shit out, ship out. Casablanca. Set during World War II, it focuses on an American expatriate, played by Humphrey Bogart, who must choose between his love for a woman, played by Ingrid Bergman, and helping her husband, played by Paul Henreid, a Czechoslovak resistance leader, escape from the Vichy-controlled city of Casablanca to continue his fight against the Germans. That's basically it. It's like spycraft and intrigue and impossible love. It's like everything is in this fucking movie. Anything you could possibly want from a fucking movie is in Casablanca.
Like I don't know what else I could ask for in a film.
Okay, so let's start right at the top. Is there, when you think of old Hollywood, is there someone else that comes to mind before Humphrey Bogart?
Not that I can think of.
Like the dude came out of the box with that voice and that face. And just, like, Humphrey Bogart does not have the widest range of the old Hollywood actors. But motherfucker, he does magnificently with the range that he has. He can play tough and he can play sad. And honestly, in these kind of, like, movies, that's all you really need. It's like an era of dudes with faces where the stars have mugs. And I know I've said that exact word in that exact cadence before. But goddammit, I love dudes with mugs.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why Peter Lorre is so wonderful.
Peter Lorre is the shit. I love Peter Lorre.
Yeah, he's great.
That's another guy that doesn't have a ton of moves, but he's so good in his range. It's pretty astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that Bogart is so affecting in like the way he plays things, like, yes, he only has a couple moves. A, he's great at those moves, and I think that the way he plays tough, it's that perfect way to play it where you can tell there's something underneath it. You're never going to directly see it, or maybe you'll see glimpses of it here and there, but he moves with a broken kind of confidence, I guess I might say, where you can tell that there's more to him than just what he says, and there's more to him than he wants anyone to know about or that he wants to let on. And it's such a difficult thing in a lot of acting. There's so many tough guys that you don't get that in, but there's a reason he's a movie star. There's a reason he is iconic.
The Humphrey Bogart secret sauce is that he's sad.
Yeah.
He's very sad. And this is a movie in which he is not only sad, but gets to be vulnerable. And that's fantastic. And the person he is vulnerable to and for might be one of the most radiant screen presences in the history of the movies in Ingrid Bergman. This movie's fucking perfect, dude. Like it's such a cliche, but no, this movie's got everything. And it's well directed, the script kicks ass, the score is good, like, it's about Nazis fucking losing. Like, what do you want from me, dude?
And I think it's significant that it was released while the war was still going on.
42! This is some Charlie Chaplin shit.
Yeah, and I think I'm literally getting chills thinking about, like, releasing this in 42 and having those moments where the characters have that determination that they're going to win, that the Nazis are going to lose, that they are fighting the fight that is worth having, and that there's a beauty in the fact that they're resisting, even if they were to fail. But there's that glimmer of like, no, we are going to win. We're going to get what we need to get, and we're going to do the things we need to do, and it's going to work out, kind of. Even if it's going to be difficult, even if it's going to be hard, but yeah.
If you do not get granite hard when they start singing La Marseillaise,
yeah,
check your pulse. I don't know what to tell you. Like Peter Lorre, well, he's good, but Claude Rains is awesome in this movie.
Wonderful.
Like noir, yeah. Noir all-star Sydney Greenstreet is also kick-ass in this movie. I mean, this is a gush fest. This is not great criticism, I acknowledge that, but this is like, it's like, what are the cons? Like, what's, like, here's the thought experiment. What is the thing you would change about Casablanca?
Literally nothing. Like, I can't think of a single thing. Change? I'd be like, you know, you can take that out. Like, no, there's nothing I dislike about it.
It's like, what, do you have him go with her in the plane at the end? No. Absolutely fucking not.
No.
Like, everything is in its right place. I mean, they got it in one. What can I say? This movie's perfect. 5 stars. It's not often we get to say this, but fuck, they got it in one.
Yeah.
No notes.
I literally don't have notes. I have notes for all the other things, but like watching it, I was like, yep, they did it. Good job.
Good job, Michael Curtiz and co. You made one of the greatest movies ever made. But now we have to talk about Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
Which is also basically perfect, no notes.
100%. I fucking adore Barry Lyndon.
Your first go around?
No, second go around.
Okay.
Because I watched it for the
Oh, right. The
previous version of this pod.
Oh my god. Okay, so Barry Lyndon. This is I think I called this before we started recording the hipster's favorite Barry Lyndon movie, because I was clued into this movie by a buddy of mine that I went to film school with.
Stanley Kubrick film movie. You said the hipster's favorite Barry Lyndon movie.
Okay, the hipster's favorite Stanley Kubrick movie.
Yes.
So what the hell do we call this? It's like
it's a film of incident.
It's definitely a film of incident. How does one say? So Wikipedia describes it as the early exploits and later unraveling of an 18th century Anglo-Irish rogue and gold digger who marries a rich widow to climb the social ladder and assume her late husband's aristocratic position.
It's a picaresque movie about a fail son.
And get this. This is a casting coup like no other. Ryan O'Neill plays an asshole.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
It's Ryan O'Neill, another guy with not like a ton of moves, but if you get him to play like an irascible dick, just magic. The other thing that he can do is completely stoic with no emotions, which is why we have the wonderful film The Driver. But this, he gets to play just a total fucking cock. That's brilliant. This movie is very well heralded for its sort of naturalistic cinematography. It's very painterly compositions. It is not only a movie of incident, in the mise-en-scene, in the script itself, but it is a film of incident in the fucking blocking and setting up of this fucking movie. There's a lot of to-do in Stanley Kubrick movies, but this one in particular, and many tales of cameras with custom lenses, like, manually ground down so they would be able to capture footage at low light, because the only thing they used to light this fucking thing was the sun and some candles.
Yeah, like...
absurd. Mad lad.
The closest thing I can compare a lot of the cinematography to, in like the incredibly precise way the framing works, the incredibly like painterly aspect that you're mentioning, is like Peter Greenaway. Like that clearly influenced...
Isabel, our favorite.
I adore the man. That clear influence from like Renaissance and Baroque painting, and like the compositions themselves are just... you could pull basically any frame out of this movie and be like, holy shit. What a piece of work. And it's also, like, I think a 3-hour period piece, picaresque film by Stanley Kubrick sounds like it might be a bit of a drag. This movie's fucking hilarious.
It's very funny.
It opens with a joke that made me laugh out loud the first time I saw it.
It's if you've never seen Barry Lyndon, I'll spoil this one. It's a super wide shot. I forget what the narrator is saying, something or other. But the sort of the punchline of that joke that the of the narrator is a duel in the far, far background, where it's like a puff of smoke and someone going, ugh! And it's like completely without incident. Someone died and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's it's Barry Lyndon's dad, if I remember correctly.
There we go.
Because the narration is all about like, oh, like, here's all about like, because his name isn't Barry Lyndon. To start with, it's Redmond Barry. Essentially being like, here's all the like amazing things that his father did and like what Redmond Barry could have been, but his dad died.
He gets the opposite of a hero's death.
Yes, it's such a funny intro. And it's the constant purposeful deflation of the romantic period piece. Like, everyone in this movie is sad or bored. Uh-huh. Or sad and bored. Redmond Barry keeps failing upwards. Failing upwards into what should be a better life. And he is never happy. His life always kind of just fucking sucks. Until there's a couple moments where he really is enjoying himself. And then he gets a horse for his child.
Oh, no.
And you should...
we're laughing, but it's like...
It's... I think the reason it's so effective is because it's one of the parts of the movie that cuts out the comedy, essentially.
It's so bleak.
It just goes from this, like, very dark but very funny movie to all of a sudden, like, fuck. This just
sucks ass.
Yeah. It has the... So, very, very short version is that Redmond Barry thinks he kills a man in a duel. Doesn't actually, but he's made to think that, so he goes away. He's Irish, and he goes away somewhere else. He ends up enlisting in the army in... What's the conflict? I forget.
I believe it is the Seven Years' War.
Thank you. And he eventually pretends to be an officer, gets found out that he's not an officer, gets enlisted to spy or like be a double agent in a different way, and eventually...
Cheats at cards a bunch.
Cheats at cards. Eventually gets in the good graces of an aristocratic woman, marries her, has a kid, and it seems like, oh, maybe it's okay. And then the kid fucking dies. His other, like, his stepson hates him.
Hates his ass.
For good reason, because he's a piece of shit. And Redmond Barry, at that point, Barry Lyndon, dies sad and alone.
So here's, like, the metonymy of what we just said. So the movie has two parts and an intermission, because it's fucking classy like that. Part one is subtitled, "By What Means Redmond Barry Acquired the Style and Title of Barry Lyndon." And part two is called "Containing an Account of the Misfortunes and Disasters Which Befell Barry Lyndon."
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, does it open with a narration saying, like, here's all the things that he would get, and by the time he died, he would have none of these things?
I forget, like, I think it's at the beginning, because at the end it's like something like, richer or poor, for a rich man, poor man, something or other, they are all equal now, because they're all fucking dead.
Yes.
One thing I really like about this movie that I'll say, for all its, for all its painterliness, is I love that the camera goes haywire every time Ryan O'Neal decides to fight someone.
Yes.
Two examples of this. Early on, whenever he is, I think he is enlisting in his, this guy has no national allegiance, really. He's in the British Army first. And, you know, Irish, blah, blah, blah. And then he bare knuckle boxes a guy. Cool. And then that kind of gets called back in the second part during, I guess, like a viola recital or whatever.
Yeah.
Like everyone's wearing powdered wigs and makeup and shit. And this is when his stepson is like, ah, man. This is where things boil over with his stepson. And he just, like, he, like, gives it to him. There's, like, an all-out brawl. And, you know, I'm a simple man. Dudes in powdered wigs beating each other up, always funny.
I would agree. I just love, like, Barry as a character because he's so pathetic and, like, petty and childish. Like, no matter how old he gets, he's always this, like, kind of childish little man who has no impulse control half the time, who is so focused on his version of his pride and his version of what he should be. I mean, it's bringing back to, like, the Deer Hunter thing. Like, this is what a man should be. Like, the entire thing that starts the plot is that he's insulted that his cousin, who he wants to make fucky with,
did you say make fucky?
Yes, I did. I said it one time as a joke to my partners. Now we always say it as just, like, the generic term for have sex. Like, make fucky.
Make fucky.
So, Barry wants to make fucky with his cousin, and she's into someone else.
Like, that was a normal thing.
She's into someone else. And this is such an insult to him. Instead of letting it the fuck go, which he could, and he'd be fine the rest of the movie. Nothing bad would have happened. But no, he has to, like, challenge this motherfucker to a duel because of his honor. And it just sets him off on a terrible path of misery.
This entire movie is Barry Lyndon going, I heard you were talking shit.
Yes. And I will say also, big highlight for me, especially early on, like, I think one of the best scenes, especially early in the movie, is when he gets robbed.
Oh, the highwayman robbery is so funny.
Yes, it is so dryly hilarious, the way that they phrase everything and the matter-of-factness in which they steal all his shit. Except his boots. They're very nice and don't steal his boots. It's hilarious.
Isabel, we gotta pick between these two movies.
Can I say one more thing about Barry Lyndon?
Yeah.
The dueling scene is one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever.
The at the end?
Yes. There's a part towards the end where, because he's a piece of shit, and also his stepson's kind of also a piece of shit, and also very short-tempered and short-sighted, he challenges his stepfather to a duel, and it's after the movie is, like, really kind of starting to crush down on Redmond Barry. The first thing that happens is his stepson fucks up in, like, testing the gun, essentially, and shoots in a completely different direction, and that counts as one shot. So now Barry gets his shot, and he purposely shoots into the ground to be like, hey, we don't have to do this. It's fine. Like, let's just call this off. But nope, his son's like, fuck that. I'm going to throw up while we're doing this because I'm so stressed out. I've never shot anyone. This sucks, but I'm so determined at this point, and I'm so focused on this goal of maintaining what I think my pride and my masculinity should be that I'm going to shoot my stepdad no matter what, even though he's trying to make amends, essentially. And it's really darkly funny. It's tragic. It's heartbreaking, especially, like, seeing Barry purposefully waste his own shot and then giving him his stepson the chance and him not taking it.
Pretty, like, it's a kind of a gut punch moment in the movie.
Yeah. This is a video game comparison, but I don't really like The Last of Us, but I like The Last of Us Part 2 quite a bit, actually. And one of the best moments in it, I'm not going to give spoilers for it, but there's essentially a character who more or less at one point is, like, seeking revenge on another one, and it's an exhausting amount of revenge, like, I think purposefully exhausting. And the other character, when they finally, like, meet up together, for I think it's the second time, the other character who, is the one being sought out for the revenge
is like, what the fuck? I let you go. Like, why are you still doing this? This, why are you still continuing this fucking pointless thing you're doing? And it very much has that kind of same energy. And I just like that as a vibe. It's always like very heartbreaking. Like, you had this chance to go back to how things were, but your stubbornness and your pride is making it so you can't.
It's like, you clearly do not want to do this.
Yes. Like, he's literally vomiting, like, as it's happening. His stepson is.
And it's also just, like, just a stone-cold ending to this.
Yeah.
Just no warmth, no love. Just, it's just business, baby.
So what are you thinking?
So these two... Oh, I'm thinking that this is going to be a difficult choice. So I'm not concerned for Stanley Kubrick's presence in round two.
Or in round three, or round four, or round five.
But, like, because this is, like, an instance where it's, like, I would flip a coin. Because I can't, because, again, what are the parts you delete from Barry Lyndon?
Nothing.
So, we find ourselves at an interesting impasse. Time is not really an issue here, because, unlike the Deer Hunter, Barry Lyndon isn't really dour.
Yeah, no, it's not...
It's not a tough 3 hours.
Yeah.
And Casablanca is totally breezy. So this really does come down to, like, which one is better. But I don't know which one is better, because both of these movies are five-star classics for me. On, like, if I go on my Letterbox, they're both five. So I don't know. I got to do some real soul searching. And not to spoil round two, but both of these movies will have their way with Toy Story.
Yeah, 100%.
So it really is like, how do I parse this?
Here's what I will say, is if either one is essentially a coin flip, which I would pretty much agree on, I think they're both more or less perfect movies. My deciding factor right now is I still have more notes for Barry Lyndon. Like, I have more things to say, and I think there's more text there for us to dig into. Whereas Casablanca, I feel like when we get to next round, we're just going to be like, yep, fucking amazing movie again.
We're already doing that now.
Yes. And I think where I have kind of run out of things to say about Casablanca. It's great. Go fucking watch it. If you haven't seen it for some reason, watch Casablanca. It's amazing. I can almost guarantee you'll love it. But I don't have anything new. That's it.
So if I look inward... And I go to, like, the deepest recesses, like, of my gut. And I'm like, and if I have to, like, sort of pull out a take out of a bag. And it's like, which is, like, if someone held a gun to my head, it's like, which is better, Casablanca or Barry Lyndon? I would piss my pants. And then I would probably say Casablanca. Now, by the slimmest of margins, by, like, just, like, the slimmest shave. Just, like, a bee's dick's width. Between the two. But we have to keep the pot in mind. We need material for round two. So with that, there's no sense in using a veto for one of these. It's not worth it. Both of these movies are... like, it's like the second I saw both of these against each other, it's like, this is one of those... this is just one of those matchups that had no business happening in round one. But that's the way the bracket gods lined it up. And so to that end, with a bit of a twinge, as I'm about to say it, I welcome Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon into round two.
Finally, Stanley Kubrick getting his due.
That's right. But I have to say, I have to echo what Isabel just said. If you have not seen Casablanca, fucking get right. Sit your ass down and watch this fantastic movie.
Whew.
We got there.
We did it. So what's happening next round?
So our next two matchups for our next episode are going to be Good Will Hunting versus Dial M for Murder and Saving Private Ryan versus The Terminator. Tom Hanks strikes again!
I have thoughts about some of these movies. People will have to tune in to learn what those thoughts are. Are they positive? Are they negative? I think you can guess some of them, but can you guess all of them? Because maybe I'll have hot takes.
You know, I've never seen Saving Private Ryan.
Fascinating.
It's going to be interesting.
I'm not going to say anything.
No, I know. I can kind of guess, but we'll see. So this is usually the part of the show where we do plugs, except I've got nothing to plug anymore.
Yeah, I don't really have anything either. I mean, if you want to follow me on Twitter.com, it's still Lilies Without. If you want to follow me on Blue Sky, it's still Lilies Without. I don't post a ton on either one. If you want to find me on Tumblr, too bad. I'm not going to give that one out because I like that one. I like having my own little secret space. It's not even that secret. Like, it's not that hard to find. But I like having it as like a non-public facing system.
DerekGade.com. I'm not a hard person to get a hold of. But yeah, we got nothing else to plug. Yeah, that's it. I've got, like, I used to plug Twitter, Letterboxd. I mean, that's all on my website now.
That sounds convenient.
It's like, if you want to get a hold of me, if you want to get in touch with, oh, the Discord. If you want to join the Discord.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to put a link in the show notes.
There are still some brave souls posting on it, and I always enjoy when they do. They're the Brainworms page is delightful.
Oh, which I have muted.
There's also the Cuervo Gold, which is the music one. Found some neat music. It's also where we posted a bunch of screenshots of the new Beatles music video, which is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It's great.
That is. That's a Peter Jackson joint too.
Sure is. What happened to Peter Jackson? Like, good.
The same thing happened to Peter Jackson that happened to fucking Robert Zemeckis.
He's got too into the tech?
Yeah. He's gotten way too into the tech. I am
Give him
going
some
to
blood
go
bags.
To New Zealand. I am going to go to New Zealand and kick his ass myself.
Just give him a fucking like lawnmower and a priest costume again. That's all we need.
I mean, I would give almost anything for Peter Jackson to make another gore comedy.
Honestly.
That's not what he's into now.
It's tragic.
Hell, I would, like, if he were to do, like, The Frighteners 2 with someone, I'd be into that, too.
Good movie.
But, yeah, perfectly solid. 7 out of 10. Or, Michael Jackson. Michael J. Fox is good in that.
Yeah. Or, hey, just shoot more stuff on fucking vacation. Non-vacation. I mean, hey, do that in 2, but shoot more stuff on location. Because, like, The main problem I have with so much of The Hobbit, I've only seen the first two of The Hobbit movies, haven't seen the third one yet. They made one of the dwarves a pretty boy, and I don't like that at all. They should all be little freaks, in my opinion. Number two, it shouldn't be 3 fucking movies. Like, good lord, there's so much fucking filler. And number three, is it so much of it was clearly shot on a soundstage when it didn't need to be, and it's hideous for parts of it. Like, it's... there was plenty of CGI in the Lord of the Rings movies, but at least there was like the sense of you being in a place was so much stronger.
Yeah, but there was also a lot of like real grass and trick photography.
Yeah. Or hey, just make another Heavenly Creatures. That's also pretty neat.
Peter Jackson, if you make another splatter comedy, I will give you $50 Canadian. That's not my final offer, but it's my first offer.
Hey, I'll give him $50 American.
Oh, shit. Now we're talking.
Yeah.
That's got to be at least 150 Canadian. Oh, boy. On that note, I believe the only thing that we have to do before we wrap this sucker up is say our names. So I will leave the floor to you.
I've been Isabel Arf.
And I've been Derek Gade. Have movies. Be jolly.
Have movies. Be jolly. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. And be careful with things that you stick up your ass.
Approved products only. Sponsored products only.
That's right.